How do the best data scientists in the world master their data sets, train their models, and climb the data science ladder? Let's ask them. My name's Jeremy, and this is the Towards Data Science podcast.
Institution you're coming from, you can get access to the very latest research.
We also have to make sure that we're constantly revisiting our foundations and justifying why we're using the methods we are.
At that time, I said, and I want people to hear this, that you have worth and you have skills, and there's someone who needs that somewhere.
Hello and welcome everyone once again to another episode of the Towards Data Science podcast. My name is Jeremy, and as usual, I'm on the team over at the Sharpest Minds Data Science Mentorship Program. And there's been a lot of talk in data science circles about techniques like AutoML, which are dramatically reducing the time it takes for data scientists to train and tune their models and create reliable experiments. But that trend towards increased automation, greater robustness and reliability doesn't end with machine learning. Increasingly, companies are focusing their attention on automating earlier parts of the data lifecycle, including the critical task of data engineering. Now, today, most data engineers are unicorns. They not only have to understand the needs of their customers, but also how to work with data and what software engineering tools and best practices to use to set up and monitor those pipelines. Pipeline monitoring in particular is time-consuming, and just as important, it's really not a particularly fun thing to do. Luckily, people like Sean Knapp, a former Googler turned founder of data engineering startup Ascend.io, are leading the charge to make automated data pipeline monitoring a reality. Now, Sean's our guest for today's episode of the podcast, and he's got a lot to say about best practices in data science and data engineering and how to keep teams working together in constructive ways. So I'm really looking forward to diving into this one. Sean, thanks so much for joining us for the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, really happy to have you here. You have a ton of experience managing data teams at scale. And with that comes obviously a deep understanding not only of the technical and implementation issues that come with that, but also the political challenges involved in getting large groups of people to collaborate on these kinds of projects. So we'll be discussing that today, I'm sure, but I think it'd be helpful to start by giving people a little bit of a sense of where you come from, what your backstory is. Because although your career started at Google, front-end development, it's taken a much more data-focused direction. Can you walk us through how that happened?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. You know, my career really, I think, has sort of grouped into three or four distinct phases. It actually, you know, as you mentioned, started as a front-end engineer at Google, where we were doing a lot of experimentation on users for web search. So what color should we put behind the ads on web search, or should we lay out the page this way or that way? And that was, ironically, my first experience with big data and data science and analytics, because as we ran all these experiments, we had to analyze the efficacy of those. So I found very quickly I was writing more MapReduce jobs to process data and analyze the results. And this was, gosh, back in 2004, than I was even writing front-end code. And so that was really my first taste of it. The sort of second wave of my career really fast was when I started a company called Uyala with two other of my coworkers. And we scaled that to about 500 people before we were acquired. And we were really a very data-oriented play around online video distribution. We sold to 600 companies around the world and powered everywhere from ESPN to US Equestrian Foundation and all their online video. But we collected 4 billion data points a day, telemetric data, provided recommendations, ad targeting, you name it, to end consumers. So that was a massive big data experience of working with everything from Storm to the earliest stages of Spark and Cassandra and Hadoop, and then eventually Spark streaming. And so we worked with a lot of different technologies and scaled the data team there to 50 or 60 people. And now, most recently, for the last 4 years, I am the founder and CEO of a company called Ascend.io. And what we've really been trying to tackle here has been the next, what we see the next wave of challenges. You know, we as data engineers have been continually using new technologies and moving up the stack, if you will. And the last 10, 15 years has been around how do we store more data or process more data? But there hasn't been enough for us as data engineers and data scientists and analysts to actually go and build more things that are lower maintenance burden on us. And so we wanted to build something that sat on top of all those tools and make it easier for us to build faster, to connect more data, to do more complex transformations, and then frankly, put these things on autopilot so that we can go move on to the next project. We can move faster and have, you know, not get paged at 3 a.m. and I can really focus on building instead of sustaining. And so for the last 4 years, we've been building this intelligence layer for the data science and data engineering on top of the modern big data stack.
And what would you say, because this sort of borders on the idea of AutoML a little bit, almost like AutoML, but for data engineering to some extent. Do you have a sense of what fraction of people's time and data engineering time is spent on these kinds of maintenance tasks?
Yeah, it's funny. It's pretty deceiving because the sort of hello world of data engineering, it can oftentimes be pretty straightforward, right? I got to pull some data out of somewhere, maybe an API, maybe a data lake. I'm going to do some ETLing stuff. I'm going to, you know, synchronize it in, join some stuff, like do a bunch of things that actually seems like it's more or less a SQL query just off of a different data set. And then I'm going to go put it somewhere. And we see that the sort of hello world is very different than the real world, where when you start to worry about like, how do I keep that thing running? What do I do if the data upstream changes? How do I track the lineage of it? Where did that data go? Because I'm creating copies of derivative data sets. And so these derived data sets, can I trust them? Like I'm building a model on top of a derived data set that is three hops downstream from the raw data. But if the raw data changes, how do I know if I can trust the derived data? And all of this is data engineering, where that simple pipeline, if you will, ends up becoming incredibly complex to actually trust. And so the majority of engineering time is either, you know, first you implement very quickly and you're really happy. And then you end up spending, you know, 30, 40, 50% of your time maintaining. And then usually people end up trying to build all these safeguards around their system. But this is why the reality is, you know, what are fairly simple, straightforward SQL queries from a logic perspective end up becoming thousands of lines of data engineering code. And so this is what, you know, we really hope to resolve, is get people focused back on the data itself as opposed to the movement and orchestration of data.
I think when you were referencing hops, at least I take that to be a reference to basically data version control, right? Different.
Yeah, like what you'll see there's two aspects of it. One is as you're creating incremental models of your data, right? You want it to actually persist and keep those versions. The second is, as your data is moving through, the data itself may change, and you need to know whether or not your code changed or the data itself changed, and you need to be able to maintain the linkage between those two.
Yeah, I think that's one of those things that's really counterintuitive for people who aren't working in data science and industry. Seeing that like model building and data cleaning isn't this static thing, it's not a moment in time, everything implicitly is a time series problem, really.
Yeah, the data's moving, the code's changing, you have more people moving on, you get this polynomial expansion of complexity when you think about like how much data you have, the data sources, how much faster it's coming in, how many more systems, and then frankly, how many more hands-on keyboards, right? Like all of us, as data engineers or data scientists, are all creating more of these things, and these models, these pipelines, all of these systems aren't just like, hey, we create it and then we throw it away a little bit later. Like they end up going into production. So you get this compounded complexity over time that is just a prime opportunity for high levels of automation and even autonomy.
Well, and I guess every time you introduce another one of those dimensions, essentially you're adding like another skill that employees need to have if you want to scale your company fast. Like I imagine a lot of this really is about, you know, making it possible even for some companies to achieve any kind of scale, because otherwise you need like a unicorn for every data engineer.
Yeah, totally. Like in the it far exceeds what's a very romantic notion of like the polymath engineer, where you're like, oh yeah, you understand everything from, you know, complex data models and the math and the science behind this out to like distributed systems, and you can write in everything from SQL to Scala and everywhere in between. It just becomes really hard. And especially for us as data scientists and engineers too, is one of the things we don't like doing is we don't like maintaining. Like that feels incredibly agonizing for all of us, right? And so we like to go build, but when we build, we're building on top of these layers. And if those foundations are continuing to creak under the weight and load, business, like as we create more things, we kind of keep just getting pulled back into like trying to tweak and retrofit those. And so if we can automate more of those underlying systems, it frees us as engineers and scientists to focus on the next thing and keep building and moving forward.
So in terms of that automation then, because I imagine this is a really big challenge. I mean, it's hard for me to think of, well, I guess there's a set of challenges that come from the automation that are probably easier to solve. But then there are things where, you know, human intervention is necessary. You know, I'm not sure exactly when, but maybe weird anomalies arise and people just need to keep their eyes on different server loads or whatever. Like, what are the categories of problems that you found it easiest to address? And then what are some of the bigger challenges that you're still facing on the horizon?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So, you know, what we've generally found is you kind of group them into the two buckets of what are the things that machines are really good at, and what are the things that humans are really good at. And like super high level, the things humans are really good at are connecting the data to the real world itself and actually saying, I understand the business, I understand what this data itself means, but I can create a model, a compact SQL query or a bit of code to actually describe what I want you to go do with the data. What machines are really good at are things that require like building up statistical models or massive analysis, tracking and storing state to understand what came from where. And so what we found was a lot of the notion behind data engineering and everything that feeds, whether it's ML or data science, is it kind of boils down to the question of what have I done and what needs to be done next when you think of code running on data. And the core technology we built is what we call a data-aware technology, is for every fragment, piece of data, we know where it came from, what version of the code ran on it, how it got there, how many resources it took to get that, like, or how much memory did it have, et cetera, and then everywhere it went. And so we keep this really tight binding between those, because then we know, well, gosh, if the code changes, we probably need to reprocess the upstream data and propagate it through because somebody's depending on it. Or if the data itself changed, like let's say there was some bad entries in one of the files, so somebody fixes it. If the system notices it, which ours does, and say, oh gosh, like all these downstream things are operating on an old piece of data, I can automatically flow everything through because it maintains all that state. And this is what we spend a lot of time on as data engineers, is putting in all of these sort of conditional logic and check to be like, did anything change? Because you're really just trying to answer a handful of questions, which is, did something change? Because if something changed, I clearly need to go do something, I as the system, right? So I need to go process something. And then you're going down this path of, well, what did change? What's the minimal amount of work that I need to do to propagate it through? And then where do I put, like, what do I do next? And so by automating that, we figured out how to say, like, if you describe your whole world in Python, like snippets and SQL, we can actually compile that whole thing and track all of the lineage and automate that for you. So you know, we basically remove a bunch of this notion of the data movement itself. You can describe the world in a declarative notion, which makes it feel more static. So you don't have to worry about, hey, data is constantly flying through. And instead, you can say, I just am describing how I want the data to look. Ascend engine, go figure out the rest, if you will.
And so you're doing this essentially by using state, by storing a bunch of metadata that allows you to treat this problem as a static problem.
Right. We did this notion of most software engineering domains usually starts with this construct around imperative engineering, right? Where you're saying, like, I need to do some work, so I'm going to and run a bunch of conditions and move data through from one state to the next. And it tends to be a very heavy code model. And eventually we always end up evolving towards declarative models, where you say, I'm just going to describe the end state and put in a domain-specific control plane, which is part of the technology we have that understands all of the code and connects the actual state of the system to the model the developer creates. And as a result, our whole engine is tracking up to billions of fragments of data, where they came from where they're going to, and doing all of these checks for us. So we as engineers and data scientists can just sit at a higher level.
And I think there's also kind of a take home here for just people, even data scientists, like if you're not a data engineer, but you know, you're trying to adhere to some kind of best practice, the idea of knowing where your data came from, versioning it properly, versioning your models properly, like all that stuff really does generalize. Really cool. Actually, one thing I do want to ask you about too, because you've not only done these, solved all these technical problems and you're working on them, there's also a human element to this as well. And this speaks a little bit to politics, but often I think people can have a hard time imagining the human challenges of doing work at scale. And when we were chatting a little bit earlier, you brought up this idea of the data mutiny, which is one particular kind of challenge in that category. Could you explain what a data mutiny is?
Yeah, the one of the surefire ways of creating a mutiny where you basically have one team revolting against another team, right, is you give them conflicting goals, right? We see the world usually break into two or three clusters, right? You have an infrastructure team who they provide the platform. They're the ones making sure that your Spark clusters run really big and your data lake scaling, and you have a lot of the tools in the platform. And they care a lot about cost, stability, security, privacy. That's usually their corporate mandate. And then you end up with the data engineering team, the team that's building on top of that infrastructure. They're creating the pipelines that are connecting all the various upstream data sources to your warehouses or refined data sets in a lake, and making it available for analysts, for data scientists. They're doing a lot of the plumbing work, and they care about speed, flexibility, and low maintainability because they're having to productionize a bunch of these systems. And then we end up with what we call the data consumer category, data scientists, data analysts, who are taking those derived data sets oftentimes, creating new models, maybe wanting them to go get productionized again, and pushing things back upstream to the data engineers. And what this group cares about is speed, flexibility, and access to data. And when you start to cluster these three groups, their goals aren't always aligned, right? Like security and privacy is like fundamentally opposed to flexibility and access, right? When we think about the low maintainability, fantastic. But again, like that's hard if you're looking for really fast access to data and you want to whip up a bunch of models. Those don't start highly maintainable. And so what we observe from our vantage point working with all sorts of different data teams is oftentimes you kind of walk in and the infrastructure team's working on like a big multi-year replatforming project. The data engineering team is like super jammed. And they're like, look, like we're just trying to connect some pipes and keep up with demand. And the tickets are like flying in faster for new data sets and we can keep up with. And the data scientists are usually on the side of like, dude, we've been waiting forever for so much data. This is taking so long. It's killing us. And we know everybody else is working hard, but we just can't wait. Like we're just going to like go buy other technology if we can't go fast enough. And so you see this dynamic play out a lot. And it's a hard one to track, but this is a hard one to watch, but this is really how you end up starting and introducing a mutiny. You give these teams their own siloed mandates without kind of looking at this holistically.
So three different loss functions versus one loss function. And
yeah.
Which I guess is the way life works. But so how do you solve that problem? Because I imagine like coming up with a single loss function for these three disparate groups who do have, I mean, the fact that they have these different loss functions is itself a reflection of their specialization. Like in a way, it's hard to tell a data engineer that you should be worried about data access because they don't necessarily have a fine handle on what that would even mean or what kind of data access would be most beneficial for modelers and so on. Is this something that you have tried to solve or looked at?
Yeah, we've worked with a bunch of different folks. We at my last company, I think we solved for it in different ways, especially because we started smaller. So we built the constructs of the organization itself differently, which was great to learn and from that. I think there's a few things. One, the easy one is cross-functional teams really help here. Like, go grab lunch with your favorite data engineer and infrastructure manager. Like that would be a good thing. Share stories, do cross-functional hackathons. We do quarterly hackathons and get teams all working across different boundaries with each other so they better empathize with the different journeys. I think that's some of the easier wins. I think the big wins really come from the notion of like, we've seen similar challenges before, just not in the data domain. We've seen this in software development and this whole push through for the DevOps sort of era was, frankly, at a really high level. Like if I put my CTO hat on, right? What is you're really going after is how do I enable more people to build more software faster, but safely, right? And is the faster yet safely. And we have the ability to do the same thing when it comes to data, right? We want more people to work with more data, produce more derived value faster, safely. And it doesn't work by just simply outright applying the same DevOps principles, but you can start to look at some of those core elements of it. You know, DevOps did a really good job of a handful of things. Introduction of more and more microservices that you can better test discreetly, that you can automate a lot more around, that you can move more towards declarative models as opposed to imperative models. The whole push around moving faster so that you have smaller incremental changes that are easier to test. We can apply really similar things to the data world itself around heavy automation. We should lean less and less on manual systems and things that are really high code. We found time and time again, it doesn't scale. These are the things machines are really good at, tracking everything people are doing, interpreting models and executing on behalf of the developer. Smaller, cleaner systems. We work with a lot of folks. You take these like big, massive, complex pipelines or models, and you look at, I was talking to a big Fortune 500 the other day, and their revenue calculation that goes into their earnings report is 10,000 lines of SQL. And you just look at this and like, we should probably refactor this, right? Let's break this up into discrete models where each incremental calculation should be able to be persisted, analyzed, inspected, stored, just as we used to break apart all these monolithic, like single code bases and started to chop them up into microservices. We can do the same thing there. And so once you start to make things smaller, once you start to automate a ton more around it and make it more descriptive and declarative as opposed to imperative in nature, then you can start to do a lot more testing. You can interweave different languages. So it doesn't matter if you're used to working in a notebook or in like a code editor. Either way, you can actually share and collaborate on top of these smaller, derived, automated, incremental models.
So it's kind of interesting because I think there's a theme that seems to persist across the human challenge or the human solution to the problem that you mentioned, which is having data engineers and data scientists have lunch together. And this idea of the automated approach, which is just the idea of, I want to call it robustness, or the idea of building vertically rather than horizontally. So, you know, you talk about having a 10,000 lines of SQL code. Well, that's a very horizontal strategy. I mean, you're trying to solve a whole giant problem all at once. Whereas, you know, maybe you're trying to break it up into these little, not silos, but like little mini problems that you can solve in just the same way, having a table of, you know, three people, which is, you know, one infrastructure person, one data engineer, and one data scientist. You're sort of like creating a little bit of a team. It makes me think a little bit of the Basecamp methodology. I don't know if you've looked at Basecamp for product management, but just like this idea of having these little teams where there's a designer, a front end person, a back end person, and that's like the whole team for one feature. It just sort of seems kind of similar.
Yeah, it is. And it keeps you more focused on, I think this is another really big theme we've seen is it keeps you more focused on the end value and the pull from the business itself, right? So it's the, and you never, there's two extremes on the spectrum. You know, one is all the way to the extreme of just always implement individual projects, and which oftentimes means you end up with a spaghetti mess of systems at some point. But the other extreme is let's just architect like a core platform in isolation, but usually you end up with like the field of dreams where you build it and are just hoping somebody comes, but they don't really ever. And these cross-functional teams help you actually connect that and say, hey, in pursuit of continuing to evolve our platforms and building our unified systems, let's make sure that we actually are getting pull for like what is the value of this project all the way out to the end business. and really then helps you move fast with the you know the spectrum of skill sets required, and think more rationally around how that fits into the bigger picture.
So there's also then a time horizon conflict implicit in all this, where you have some teams that are focused on solving today's problems, and then other teams that have no choice but to look at like where are we going to be at 4 quarters from now.
Yeah, exactly. And this is one of the really hard ones. And this is like one of the biggest feeds we see into the data mutiny is, you know, you'll see those central infrastructure and IT teams like, hey, I'm running on a 2-3 year roadmap to replatform everything, and I've actually we've been talking to like some of the really big financial institution engineering teams, and you talk to their IT org, and God, they have this like really really cool roadmap and path, and then you talk to one of the data scientists, and they're like, hey, I can't wait for that to happen, but in the meantime, the CEO is calling me for numbers because he's meeting with this other CEO in 2 hours.
Yeah,
and they may not be 100% accurate, but directional accuracy is better than nothing at all. So I got to go, right? And so you see that disconnect in those different time horizons create a lot of strain.
Interesting. Yeah, it never occurred to me that kind of time horizon pressure would be a factor here, but it makes perfect sense. And I guess there's also the risk too, that anytime you have a really long time horizon, you know, the infrastructure team might build that out, and then lo and behold, 2 years later, it turns out it's obsolete or it's not necessary or whatever.
Yeah, totally. Like, you know, 2 years ago, I would say most infrastructure teams, as they were, you know, executing towards their warehouse strategy, Snowflake probably wasn't on their, maybe it was on their radar, but probably not part of their strategy. But now I'm pretty sure it's on everybody's.
Absolutely. Actually, so one maybe a related notion too, I've seen you write about this actually for Towards Data Science in the past. You've written about what you call data warehouse anti-patterns, which, as I understand it, sort of different pathological ways that data warehouses can be stretched beyond their limits in some sense. Could you unpack that idea a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. We see in the landscape today, there's two very big companies who are kind of battling at the moment for, like, do I need a data lake or do I need a data warehouse?
Sorry, could you actually distinguish between the two for people who might not be familiar with those?
Oh, companies? Sure. So, we see, dominant player right now in data warehousing, at least in cloud, is Snowflake. Dominant player in data lakes is Databricks. And in the warehouse, I'm mostly storing structured data. In the lake, I can just store anything. It's an object store, it's S3, it's Delta Lake. And we see these, oftentimes it sits a little bit more towards the analytics and analyst camp and the data science and data engineering camp. And there's a bit of a debate right now as to like, which one should win and which one should you actually go employ? And, you know, our take is you honestly probably need both. When we look at most tech companies who are really far out ahead on the curve, they always end up with both, right? They always end up with everything sitting in that lake, but also doing a bunch inside of that warehouse.
What are some of the advantages then? Because like, is the idea, the data lake is nice because I can basically dump any old data there without worrying about structuring it. And then the structured side is nice because it's structured, more predictable. That's basically the trade-off.
Yeah. And you see, especially for things like ad hoc queries or refined data sets, more exploratory work, warehouses are phenomenal for that. And they can process at really incredible scale. And what we see oftentimes is historically, building things like data pipelines and doing things like ETL have been so hard and painful to do. You know, let's call that in the pre-Ascend era. It's really hard. Like, they're super high code, they're super brittle. We see a lot of people gravitating towards, well, gosh, like, I have this whole new generation of data warehouses that are just incredible. And they are truly, truly incredible. And what we end up seeing them starting to do is using those warehouses for pipelines.
Right.
And in short, doing things like cascading transformations of data, right? Like cascading materialized views, in essence, right? That are loosely orchestrated. And this is what we see as one of those rising anti-patterns. As you start to do that, you still lose things like data lineage, integrity checking, efficiency, and things that the warehouses are really big and really powerful these days, but still aren't a good fit for what are more classic ETL and data pipeline territory. And so that's usually the entry point for a lot of these anti-patterns that we see is you were writing all your data into the warehouse because it was easier. You know, you had a data replication tool that put it in. You can run some queries on it. You make your cluster bigger. It's getting expensive. So you're like, okay, I'm going to do a nightly roll up of this data. So I'm optimizing my cluster a little bit. And you start to go down these sort of steps of creating what are partial data pipelines inside of the warehouse to optimize for speed and cost. But we see a lot of folks usually just then struggling to try and figure out how you manage that Frankenstein over time.
Yeah. And I guess so the data lake approach a little bit more robust on that side of things.
Yeah, especially if you, and I would contend it's a little less oriented to just the pure data lake, but the notion of data pipelines, the idea behind a pipeline, even similar to more traditional ETL is if you're going to keep doing the same analysis on the same piece of data, do it once and persist the derived set. And pipelines, especially when you have a really advanced orchestration technology like Ascend, can track enough lineage that says we'll never run the same piece of code on the same piece of data twice. And as a result, if I'm, you know, let's say I'm just doing hourly rollups of data based on dimensions, a really intelligent pipeline engine can and should be able to say, oh, well, you had, you know, new data come in, had a little bit of trailing data from last hour, so I can actually re-aggregate that hour, but I don't have to actually re-aggregate all hours for all time. I distinctly know exactly what previous calculations, what slice of those should be updated now.
So it sounds like there's an interesting analogy here between the software engineering best practice and principle that, you know, if you find yourself reusing the same code more than once, you should write a function for it. In the same way, it's like if you're running the same compute on a given chunk of data, just do it once and then use the result.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a really good combination of like, how do you refactor that code? And there's also another, you just reminded me of another really great sort of previous pattern we've seen, which is like data warehouses, for example, will do a bunch of caching where they can. But because they don't track the lineage of data in the same way, oftentimes just end up blowing out the cache and having to rerun rerun everything. It's sort of like the difference between having like a fragment cache and a page cache on like a web architecture, right? Like, can you just cache the whole thing, or do you know the individual pieces you can still cache? When it comes to data pipelines, what you're doing is proactive persistence. It's basically saying, hey, as I'm moving things through, I'm going to keep a copy of this and never have to go back to the originating stuff because I know if that originating stuff changes, I know how to track it. So I know how to then invalidate this thing that I cached before. So it's a proactive caching model that is backed by a lot more data integrity checks than you would get from a traditional model.
It seems like a consistent theme here too is this idea of trading off compute for storage. Like, you know, you're storing a bunch of extra metadata in order to have the state that you need to do all this backtracking and lineage work, in order to not have to redo those computations. Is that kind of like a fair assessment of what's at the core of this trade-off decision?
Yeah, totally. 100%. What we end up storing is we store tons and tons of metadata, which fits in a standard SQL Postgres. You could put in a key value store. But that's just the really lightweight metadata. What we actually store is we store tons of SHAs. We do hashes of the code and the data itself. But the other thing you store is you persist a lot of those intermediate copies of data, but you can persist those inside of S3 or Azure Blob or Google Cloud Storage at incredibly compact and incredibly cheap rates. And you can do it in ways that are less durable because you still have the upstream data. So you know if in some rare occasion that piece of data did disappear, you know how to recalculate it safely. And so you can do all these really cool cost optimizations at the same time when you have an automated system, right? Because you just implement the rules once and it just takes care of the rest for you.
I'm thinking back, the data science part of my brain keeps thinking, or the modeling part of my brain keeps going, oh yeah, you know, this is really, this is what happens in modeling when you're like, you have a really complex model, lots of compute, and then you start thinking about, you know, where am I going to store intermediate versions of this model? If it's deep learning, you know, how many epochs in am I going to save? When am I going to save? What's the trade-off between all these different storage and compute things? So it's cool to see it show up just about everywhere.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Ultimately, what aspects of data engineering, because you're talking about so many sort of automation strategies and optimizations, what aspects of a data engineer's job today do you think are most likely to remain intact, say, over the next decade? Like, are we going to see the kind of automation we've seen on the machine learning side with AutoML? Or are we going in a different direction? Like, what are the core attributes of the data scientist of the year 2030, let's say? If you care to guess that far ahead.
Well, I think 2030, given the current landscape, is going to look very different than a lot of our original 2020 projections we're starting to point towards. So I think that there's a couple of things. If we plot the trends, and we, you know, as I mentioned before, we keep seeing people move up stack, right? A lot of the data engineers and even data infrastructure teams we see, oftentimes they were the ones that were managing the infrastructure in the data center, and then were the ones who actually helped bring people to the cloud first, and then introduced Hadoop and Spark, and you kind of keep moving up and up the stack. So I think we'll see over time more, like the big focus right now is actually, ironically, in the data engineering side, it's not actually about storing or processing more data. The focus has now been not on a processing engine, it's on a pipeline engine. And this is really why we created Ascend. Is this is the next problem to solve, is the efficiency of developers. And I think as we solve a lot of that problem, which will take us years to go do, we'll then start to move on the even further up stack, and we'll focus more on how do we enable people to build more ML, do more complex analysis, and frankly, with less code. And so the trends will continue to be for us as data engineers to move up stack, automate more of what we used to do, so we don't have to do that anymore, and we can move on to the next problem, which gets us closer to the business, closer to the end consumer.
And as you say, closer to the business, I mean, now thinking really far ahead, because I've heard similar things on the data science and data analytics side. So closer to the business starts to sound almost like a convergence of data engineering and analytics, or data engineering and data science. Like, we're almost, I mean, I don't know if this is an overreach, but almost in the really long term, starting to converge all those job descriptions in one. Do you think that's a little too extreme as a take, or is that where things could be taking us?
I think it'll ebb and flow, right? Just as we've seen in the software engineering domain, how we see, you know, the emergence of, when I started, like, they weren't even actually front-end engineers. I was a hired as a Java engineer because I was a front-end engineer back then. And so you sort of see the emergence of new roles, and then the surge of full-stack engineers, and you'll see things ebb and flow. I do think that we are seeing more and more of a trend of let's go build more that has closer connectivity to driving short-term and immediate value for the business, especially right now, given the current market. And I think as we think about the teams that we work with and collaborate with, like a lot of the data engineering teams were the first ones who wrote all the early data pipelines. And they were the Davy Crockett's, right? They were just figuring out how do you find the Pacific Ocean and how do we get through? Because for them, they knew how to run a distributed system, and they could tune the JVM, and they could build some of these pipelines, but they also realized how painful and brittle these were, and weren't something you could just go toss into the data science and data analyst community and be like, just go build it yourself. And so that's why we've seen a lot of this big focus now on, hey, what's that, not just the raw compute and storage, but what's this pipeline engine, what's this data engineering platform that sits on top that makes it more easy and automated to use, so you don't have to do all these things. You know, I think one of the really big trends that we are going to continue to see, you know, we've talked a lot about in the past the notion of citizen data scientists. That's created so much demand for data engineering and so much need to go self-serve on data and create your own systems that I do think there's this whole wave of citizen data engineering that's coming next. And it will be born by platforms that remove you from all of the muck of data engineering and make it easier to accomplish your goals.
I found it especially interesting that you tied in the current economic outlook, because you know, as the timelines of all businesses really shorten and people start to get short-term greedy doing exploitation over exploration in machine learning language, this has implications, I imagine, for people who are trying to break into the space, build up their skill set, and market themselves as data engineers, maybe even as data scientists who are just trying to build out some kind of data engineering capacity. If you were doing that today, like if you were trying to break into data engineering or up your skill set as a data scientist, what are some of the best, let's say, low-hanging fruit would you recommend in terms of maybe tooling or strategies?
Yeah, really good question. You know, I would definitely say some of the biggest areas to focus on right now are in the data engineering world. You still have to do a lot on the Python side. You still have to understand a lot of the underlying systems. But I think that's changing very quickly. I think, you know, there's tools like Ascend, there's other tools out there. Airflow is like an open source orchestration tool, but the clouds have some of their own as well. Familiarizing yourself with those tools that sit on top of standard data engineering tech is super helpful. And then, you know, the second thing I would say is really familiarizing yourself with data movement and how to track data lineage, how to solve for the problems of what happens when your data changes, right? Regulations like GDPR and CCPA, for example, have huge impact on data engineering. When a consumer exercises their right to be forgotten, you fundamentally have to go track everywhere that piece of data went and scrub it. And so understanding even some of these and how you would build a system that can support that, I think is super important.
It ties into, again, if you're a data scientist, you're starting from a modeling background, like you can actually do that. You can build, you know, projects at home and kind of just try to capture some of these possibilities. Like what would happen if I actually had to propagate through my system and remove the impact of a given data point or whatever on my model and on my all the downstream consequences?
Yeah, it's funny. You end up oftentimes like, one of the biggest responsibilities of data engineering is to deal with the fact that data starts, it's dirty. It's dirty, it's brittle, and it's late. It's like the easiest, and it's changing, right? So like all these things that basically are like all fuel instability is, you know, how do you optimize rollups of data if, you know, you may still be getting data for 2 days ago in the next hour, right? Like how do you design for a system like that? If it's all sitting in a really big database and you just query it, like you just keep writing records and you get a new result. But what happens when you have to actually move data through and keep copies of it? That's really where it turns into a really interesting and fun intellectual challenge.
Yeah, I was just thinking it sounded so Hobbesian. I thought you were going to say nasty, brutish, and short there for the data. That's great. But well, thanks so much for all your insights. I think this is just a great overview as well for, selfishly, I mean, like as a data scientist, there was so much here for me just to understand a little bit how these tools and techniques work together. I really appreciate it. If people want to follow you on social media or LinkedIn or anywhere else, are there any links that you want to share?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Is it easiest just to say my handle's just Sean Knapp, SEANKNAPP, pretty much everywhere. And I'm happy to share those links digitally too.
Perfect. Yeah. So we'll make sure we share all those links on the blog post that will accompany this podcast. If you're just listening to the podcast, guys, there will be a blog post. You can look that up. And well, thanks so much, Sean. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Jeremy, for having me.